I know we're all feeling a bit jaded by this stage, partly because of the room. So now we've got a through draft, I expect everybody to perk up. And I've unilaterally imposed a no lights decision because I would like you to be able to see the screen a little bit better, because I am going to use a number of illustrations, so I hope it'll work out okay. So I'm going to talk about the non-normative performativity of anomalous embodiment as an area that raises crucial questions for the overarching themes of this conference, which are feminism, embodiment and technology. And a lot of the things I'm going to say, I'm very happy to have noted during the day, have already emerged in other people's papers. So most of the terms I'm using are already out there on the table, which is great. Now, I'm going to focus in particular on the notion of prostheses as one potential aspect of anomalous embodiment that forces us to address the always ambivalent relationship between human subjects and biotechnology. So where in the past the term prosthesis intended a material object that compensated for some perceived lack in embodiment, the emphasis now is very firmly on enhancement and supplement. So for many disabled people, for example, their interface with the world through the medium of prostheses is no longer confined to the mode of rehabilitation, to normative practices, but offers a highly productive alternative that inevitably queers the experience itself. And going further, the notion of prostheses can be transformed to encompass a Deleuzean understanding of embodiment as necessarily entailing assemblage, encompassing both organic and non-organic forms as a mode of existence that speaks to all of us. So I want to be absolutely clear, I'm talking about anomalous embodiment simply in an illustratory way, but what I'm really talking about is the embodiment of every single one of us. Now, at heart, I'm a feminist body theorist, so I'm going to focus on what is now a major area for the understanding of human corporeality in the era of postmodernity. So I'm going to be looking in particular at disability, because it seems to me that after a very long period of neglect, feminist theory has finally found common ground with critical disability studies and its potential reimagination of the limits of embodiment. And at very least, we should be asking whether the lived experience of disability, with its potential absences, replacements, and prosthetic additions to the body, generates its own specific possibilities that may both limit and exceed the performativity of the embodied self. Now, unlike conventional disability studies that focus on the structural inequalities of Western societies in particular that produce or at very least cement states of disability, it's the social constructionist model in the UK, critical disability studies is a very diverse entity that goes way beyond this so-called social model. It encompasses both material and discursive underpinnings, the psycho-cultural imaginary, as much as law and social policy, and the phenomenology of the embodied subject, as well as the identification of any kind of identification with any kind of socio-political category. Now, in response to the theoretical and practical resources unfolding in the present time, the reassuring image of the Cartesian body as the unified, unchanging material base of continuing existence has been radically contested. And not simply by post-conventional modes of theoretical inquiry, but as we know, more pragmatically and disturbingly, I think, by contemporary bioscientific development. And it's precisely at this juncture the disabled body can raise acute questions about the always ambivalent relationship between embodied subjects, culture, and biotechnologies. Now, for nearly all of us, everyday embodiment is, as we've heard many times today, always already technologically inflected. And for many people with disabilities, it's an overt fact of life, not least in the use of prosthetic supports. So in an everyday sense, prostheses operate externally as either conventional replacements for missing limbs or internally as with transplanted organs. But in all cases, our faith in corporeal integrity is disturbed, even as we endeavour to restore the clean and proper body. So uncovering the inherent plasticity of the body and all its multiple possibilities of transcorporeality and incorporating both organic and inorganic non-self matter such modes of corporeal transformation can comprehensively undo the conventional limits of the embodied self. Now, taking an initially phenomenological approach to the lived experience of prostheticized life, I'm going to move by way of Derrida's insights into prosthetic supplementarity and his reimagination of corporeal boundaries to a Deleuzean understanding of assemblages, which mobilise an expanded notion of desire that queers not just sexuality, but conventional models of embodiment in general. And more importantly, in the respective work of both Derrida and of Deleuze, the initially deferred possibility and the disorganisation of bodily being are a matter not for nostalgia for the lost certainties, but the potential celebration of reimagining the multiple possibilities of corporeal extensiveness. So I'm just going to really start by contextualizing the word prosthesis. Now, the use of mechanical aids to enhance bodily appearance or functionality has a very extensive history. But the term prosthesis itself didn't appear until the 18th century, when it was used to denote, and this is a quote from Wills, the replacement of a missing part of the body with an artificial one. So that's a very clear binary there. And until quite recently, that deceptively simple definition was taken for granted. But in contemporary body theory, the word has come to evoke a sense in which the human technological interface has become not a matter of instrumental expediency, but of deep ambiguity and a final undecidability. And as Sarah Jane notes, prostheses are discursive frameworks as well as material artifacts. And it's in both the original uncomplicated meaning and in the contemporary highly complex notion of the prosthesis that the intimate confusion of human, animal and machine plays itself out most tellingly. So where Haraway's cyborg was once so astonishing in its imaginative implications, now critical scholarship, including that of disability theorists itself, plays with the idea that we are always already prosthetic. Now, what this means for either embodied individuals or for the sociocultural imaginary is the focus of sustained debate, but what cannot now be covered over is the insight that the human body can be manipulated, extended, or substituted seemingly without limits. And of course, the event horizon of technological singularity is waved around in front of us. I think, you know, one of the dates most recently was 2022, when machines actually overtake us. Now, the current fascination with the prostheticized body arises from the ubiquity and availability of technological interventions that have pushed the issue into lay consciousness. And as so often, the initial developments, of course, were driven by military issues, particularly following the treatment of mass casualties in the American Civil War and the two World Wars. And if anybody is interested, they should look up the DARPA website, which is the military website, the one that Google has just brought that has produced Big Dog, which is a robot to help the military carry machinery. And it's quite a terrifying video they have of it. Now, going back to the two World Wars, David Serlin wrote an article called Engineering Masculinity, and he makes clear that prosthetics in the Second World War were being used not as compensation as such for a missing limb, but to re-normalise the disabled male body. And he refers to prosthetic practice as operating within the fiercely heterosexual culture of rehabilitation medicine, especially its orthodox zeal to preserve the masculine status of disabled veterans. And the whole point of giving prostheses to male amputees was to ensure that they could pass as virile, normal men and as competent citizens. And of course, the really big thing was that they would avoid the stigma of effeminacy from being dependent. As Catherine Ott points out, the success of mid-century prosthetics was often measured in professional literature by the extent to which they enabled the wearer to engage in normal gender activities. So she's talking about things like dating, dancing, and of course, ultimately marriage. Now, at the conventional level, not much has changed. And the functionality of prostheses is often trumped by a concern for appropriate appearance. So, for example, a prosthetic hand that looks like a hand is often less functional than just a hook, but the appearance matters, and therefore you're more likely to get a rigid plastic hand rather than a useful hook. And you would see all these kind of ideas of appearance of prosthetics coming in, where women are always encouraged post-mastectomy to have breast implants, to reassert their femininity. And of course, there's the continuing popularity of penile extensions and breast implants for women who have no health reasons to do that. Now, in more recent developments, however, it's clearer how the prostheticized body, as an aspect of human enhancement technologies, can ostensibly transcend considerations of both normalizing power and gender itself. So while conventional biomedical prostheses all speak to the human-machine interface, the term could be pushed much, much further in both scope and meaning. So like Haraway's cyborg, the prosthetic body makes no distinctions between the organic and the inorganic, between the natural and the artificial, between the therapeutic and enhancement, or ultimately between the self and other. And I think some of this was coming out in Naomi's paper. So speaking of the illegitimate fusions of animals and machines, Haraway writes, here we are, wonderful, it works. These are the couplings which make man and woman so problematic, subverting the structure of desire, the force imagined to generate language and gender, and so subverting the structure and modes of reproduction of Western identity. Now, cultural critique in general, I think, has responded with both excitement and misgivings, with some people like Catherine Hales, and of course Haraway herself, who has long since abandoned the cyborg. She just classes this as one of a group of companion species now. People like Hales see this trope of endless enhancement as a nightmare. And the fear is that it heralds a future which, at the same time as appearing to deconstruct the autonomous subject, carries the Cartesian self to new heights of disembodiment. And that, of course, is very, very clear towards the end of the Cyborg Manifesto. But whatever the event of the prosthesis, and it could be something like the wooden stumps that function as legs in developing countries, it could be the transfer of a beating heart from one body to another, or the spectacles that I'm using to read my paper, it's clear that embodiment is never self-complete, nor secured against otherness, but manifests itself through a nexus of constitutive assemblages that contest the very idea of singular human being. Now, both contemporary biotechnologies and parallel theories of corporeality make clear that embodiment is never less than highly complex and indeterminate, held in place only by particular forms of a psychosocial imaginary that privileges corporeal wholeness and integrity and devalues anomalous embodiment and particularly disability. So what's at stake in even the most conventional deployments of prostheses has been then the maintenance of that sociocultural imaginary and yet at the same time an inevitable transformation in it. Now, if we take a phenomenological approach, it's clear that to rely on a prosthesis is not a matter of a self using an external technology, but of becoming embodied as hybrid. Now, in an autobiographically based article from a few years ago, Vivian Sobchak, who'd had her left leg amputated many years ago, reflects on how the prosthetic experience may entail an unsettling contestation, not only in the relation between self and other, but also any sense of the subjective self. So Sobchak shows how the lived experience of her body encompasses variously a sense of an original or originary corporeality, the absent presence of a phantom limb, and the materiality of her real, and I'm using real in inverted commas, real prosthesis. And these various elements sit together very uneasily and ambivalently, resisting any fixed attribution of meaning and significance. Now, Sobchak is acutely aware of the ways in which both the phantom affects, the appearance of which are very, very common following prosthesis. I mean, I think it's something as high as 90% to get some kind of phantom affect after some kind of excision. So she's very aware of that, and the biomedical prosthesis itself, and the biomedical prosthesis itself profoundly unsettles the conventional binaries that substantiate the clean and proper body of the psychosocial imaginary. Now, for Sobchak, the binaries of real and artificial, objective, subjective, material, imaginary, are all made undecidable. They're inadequate to capture what she then understands of her own embodied experience post having a prosthesis. And it's not that she's willfully evading any sense of fixity. She talks very openly about still striving for the sense of a whole body, but that body is constantly undone. And it's undone not by the reduction that is associated with amputation, but by the strangely expanded boundaries of her embodiment. So I want you to just look at this image. This is by the digital artist Alexa Wright. It shows a man who's had a right arm amputation, and you can see his prosthetic arm down by his side. And what Alexa has done is to digitally imagine the narrative he tells of his phantom arm. So in his feeling, in his affect, his phantom arm is in this position behind his back. And it's very whole, it's very real. Unlike the prosthetic arm, it's a recognisable hand. So his body's actually expanded. So he's had an amputation, and he has two new different elements to add to his body. Now, if the complexity, and I think we could say the slipperiness of incorporation, looms large in Sobchak's account, it's taken to another level when we consider transplantation of organs and tissues from one body to another. And I should say my major research project is on the phenomenology of transplantation. And I'm thinking here not only of things like hearts and kidney transplants, but also hands, corneas and skin. This is just an illustration of how many things get transplanted from either live or cadaveric donors. I mean, as you can see, it's a huge list. And the average transplant, when a body is used for transplantation after death, the average number of tissues or organs used is around about 7. It's very rarely a single thing. So that the body is essentially eviscerated and transported to many different recipients. Now, I want to try and get this. I think this is going to work. It did before. Now, this is a website that is actually controlled by what's called the Trillium Organisation in Ontario, where I work, which does the logistics of transplantation. They do all the publicity about being an organ donor and how you should be an organ donor, and they transplant organs and tissues around, sometimes cross-border to the States, sometimes into other provinces of Canada. And it's a very, very odd, I find, disturbing kind of thing. I hope we've got sound on this. I don't think we have. Ah, no sound. We haven't got to the good bit yet. Might change.
Same question, you've got the volume.
The volume is on high.
Welcome to RecycleMe.org, the place where recycling moves from our curbside to our inside. By clicking on this handsome tattoo, you can open me up and learn the ins and outs of organ and tissue donation. The heart, the lungs, even the eyes, they're all here for you to discover.
Okay, so we're going to click on this handsome body, as he says. Okay, we'll take this one.
You've picked the liver, your body's ultimate multitasker. This organ performs over 500 individual tasks. Can give you energy, fight infection, and clean your blood. And though the liver may have several job requirements, the only requirement you need to become a donor is the desire to make a difference.
Okay, I just want to point out some very weird things about this. beyond the obvious. The kind of transplantation he's talking about really most of it relies on cadaveric donation. Some kidney transplants are often live donations, and there are various reasons why that might be better or not, but it's generally cadaveric. But you get no sense of death in this. That, you know, death has been erased. And of course, what it's doing is talking to the cultural zeitgeist of recycling. You know, the old message was, give us your hearts and your livers and your kidneys, because you will give the gift of life and you will be an altruistic person, although dead, you are the altruistic donor. And clearly this has not really worked with younger people. So they're going for the zeitgeist of recycling as a new way of doing it, but of course presented through this absolutely clean and proper male body. You know, again, there's a very long history of the Accoucher anatomical illustrations of the early Renaissance period, precisely of opening up the body. There used to be things called fugitive sheets, where you kept opening pages and pages and pages to show the internal organs. And this is precisely harking back to, 600 years earlier. Now, this is the clean and proper masculine body, which is weird in itself. Death is erased. And the only thing that doesn't fit the clean and proper stuff is this bit in the corner, where you have a bin of recyclable organs, which is very, very weird indeed. So I find this whole thing totally spooky. And of course, it's very much talking to sort of the echo thinking, but also at the same time, it's also very neoliberal. Now, if we go back to what actually... Oh, God, it's lost its bit again. I hope this is going to get rid of it. Huh? I can't. It's lost its...
Oh, it's lost its thing.
Okay. Cancel that.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a total... here we are. Some current slides. Good. Okay. What happens in transplantation is very interesting, because for many recipients of human organic material, the literal incorporation of aspects of the other deeply complicates notions of the embodied self. You know, this isn't just a simple process. I mean, it's generally a successful operation. I mean, I deal with heart transplantation, so I'm talking about that specifically. It does save lives. You don't get a heart unless you're dying anyway. So certainly your life is prolonged. But it produces huge ontological questions about identity for the recipients themselves, and that's broadly where my research has been. So there are lots of disturbing questions for the recipients, and the unsettling effects and affects of transplantation are nevertheless often mitigated by a determined separation of the discrete materiality of the body from questions of intercorporeality. And this is a kind of affective self-containment which cuts across any comprehension of fluidity or of the co-constitution of the embodied self. But that, of course, is being contested not only by academic theorists, but as I've just said, by those who've experienced firsthand the transformatory effects of biotechnological interventions. So donated organs and tissues in particular open up the problematic of how such prosthetic interventions into human corporeality have implications for the body's supposed boundaries and unity. Now, in positive representations of biomedicine, organ transplantation is rightly presented as therapeutic, even life-saving procedure. But as with the disabled users of mechanical prostheses, the assessment of success or failure by the recipients themselves is driven by their ability to encompass the idea of hybridity that any embodied prosthesis will entail, whether it's organic or inorganic. And the ensuing form of embodiment, which could be organic in the sense of human-human, as currently transplants are, sometimes human animals, or it could be human-machine, so you could have, for example, an artificial heart. Now, I'm not going to go further into the question of transplantation here, because we'd be here all day, because it's so exciting, but it's really, the point I want to note is it's not clear that any prosthesis, transplanted or otherwise, could ever figure the unity or self-sufficiency that is supposedly integral to the nature of human being. And just as external devices like Sobchak's leg and her imaginary phantom complicate the boundaries of corporeality, so too internal procedures, visceral procedures, that implant something new speak to the undecidability of the body. Now, perhaps what all prostheses do, whether they're mechanical or organic, is to implicitly contest the very attribution of human being. So what I understand then from this imbrication of the material and a developing theoretical framework is that an unproblematized account of prostheses as replacements or stand-ins for missing parts or less than complete bodies makes no sense. In everyday terms, the implication is that prosthetic interventions make good what's lacking. But contrary to any reparative value, isn't there something about technology that undermines the stability of human being? You're not restoring some core embodied self, you're doing something quite different. Now, in addressing the conventional designation of prostheses as supplementary to an originary body, I'm immediately reminded of Derrida's logic of the supplement, through which he signals the impossibility of fixing definitions or limits. And instead, Derrida stresses the sense of deferral, the impossibility of completion, an irreducible ambiguity, and a thoroughgoing undecidability. And he argues that the very possibility of augmentation, which again we've heard about today, shows that the object must have been less than self-sufficient in the first place, from the beginning. You can't augment something unless it's already lacking in some sense, or unfinished, rather than lacking, I think. So in effect, supplementarity constitutes the object as such, so that the question of distinctions between self and other, or between natural and artificial, are revealed as undecidable. So in other words, prostheses cannot be seen as merely instrumental, but as constructing that which they purport to enhance. And then there's a further complication in the logic of the supplement as it relates to accounts of prosthetic usage. Now, if, as Derrida insists, supplementarity is always a paradox in that it implies a movement to both augment, and that means to make whole an existing object, and at the same time to substitute for or replace that object, then a prosthesis may both extend functional agency and radically destabilise human agency as such. And as Peggy Camus explains, a supplement is at once something secondary, external and compensatory, and something that substitutes, violates and usurps. So the desire for harmonious restoration, the making whole, for example, of a disabled person, or the re-establishment of normative life for a transplant recipient, cannot be fulfilled. So however they're thought, prostheses contest the unity and the integrity of the supposedly originary body, and moreover, they fatally blur the boundaries between human, animal and machine. At very least, they are about hybrid intercorporeality. Now, in the light of the material I'm outlining here, the ambiguous experience of prosthetic limbs or donated organs, which both question the integrity of the embodied self, I wonder about rethinking the whole nexus in terms of neither self-other nor of intercorporeality, but rather of assemblages. Now, the term intercorporeality, with its intimations of solid bodies, seems inadequate to the dynamic combinations, connections and rejections that constitute what we flatter ourselves to call human life. Now, the insights of Derrida concerning prostheses in the mode of supplementarity remain an important step in reimagining corporeal boundaries, but I think perhaps the Deleuzean notion of assemblage will provide new opportunities to further explore our ongoing fascination with the nature of the body. Now, in recent feminist work, the emphasis has been on the immersion of the human, and more particularly the singular I, in its environmental context of multiple complex relations, and particularly with other species. But I want to explicitly add in an account of inorganic technologies that are equally constitutive of life. And it's here that a turn to Deleuze might be more adequate. So how can it refigure the terrain? Now, in the work of Deleuze and Guattari, the embodied self, rather than being goal-driven and singular, becomes a network of flows, energies and capacities that are always open to transformation and that figure what they call desire. So Deleuze and Guattari rewrite desire as productive, accessive to the embodied self and unfixed. And this is what how Guattari explains it. He says, desire is everything that exists before the opposition between subject and object, before representation and production. It's everything whereby the world and affect constitute us outside ourselves, in spite of ourselves. It's everything that overflows from us. So instead of figuring the conventional ideal of autonomous action, separation and distinction, Deleuzean embodiment persists only through the capacity to make connections, both organic and inorganic, and enter into new assemblages, which of course are in turn disassembled. And in place of the normative organisation of the body, Deleuze and Guattari propose, quote, a body populated by multiplicities. In effect, what they promote is a deconstruction, a queering of all bodies to the extent that putative boundaries no longer function as limits. Now, if we think specifically about the disabled body in this context, it's not to single it out in its difference, still less to position it as inadequate. Rather, it's the material site of possibility, where deformations, missing parts and prostheses are enablers of new channels of desiring production that are unconstrained by normative organisation. So in short, the anomalous nature of disability embraces the strange and opens up to new linkages and provisional incorporations. So these are the connectors that make no distinctions between the human and the animal, between organic and inorganic, or between an originary body and a prosthesis. And in place of self-complete and independent subjects, Deleuze and Guattari see such assemblages as multiple and fluid. Now, like all of us in various ways, but perhaps more obviously, people with disabilities come into being through such provisional assemblages. There are human-machine assemblages, which enmesh flesh and blood with prosthetic limbs, as in the case of Sobchak. That would include things like ventilators, for example, or wheelchairs. There are human-human assemblages with families and personal assistants. There are human-animal assemblages that rely on the service of animals, such as helper dogs or monkeys. I had to show you this. Nobody believes about helper monkeys, but there's a whole organisation in the States to have your helper monkey, which is like having a helper dog. And the monkey feeds you and does the stuff. Now, politically, I'm not going there, but I just wanted to show you it's real. And then, of course, there are the much more common things like therapeutic encounters with cats and dogs, and this is particularly something that is used with people with cognitive disabilities. Now, all of these things that I'm talking about are forms of prosthesis, far exceeding superficial functionality, and engaging with production of new forms of embodiment and desire and mobilising a particular performativity of the embodied self. And I think this is really well illustrated in this ad for an upmarket wheelchair. This is a high-spec wheelchair. And again, politically I'm not going there. There's really so much you can say about this ad. If you've got time, just read round the edges. It's stunningly but I just want to pick up the single phrase here, you are what you wear. And of course, what she is wearing is the wheelchair. This is a woman with actually, I think, double hip dysplasia. And crucially, the embodied self is the prosthetic self on the way to becoming a performative assemblage. Now, again, I don't want to imply that prostheses are peculiar to those experiencing disability. You'll finish reading? Good, isn't it? As Mitchell and Snyder, who are disability theorists, point out, the prostheticized body is the rule, not the exception, and they aren't just talking about people with disabilities. Nevertheless, disabled people may be more conscious of the extension, substitution, or supplementation of their bodies, insofar as those modes are taken to speak to an originary lack. And of course, people with disabilities are very much, you know, raised in societies where that originary lack is just taken for granted and very rarely questioned. Now, I want to show you two different images, so you can see what I mean about the way in which the prosthesis is read differently. So when we have a picture here of the performance artist Stellark with his third arm, this is quite old now, maybe 10 years old at least, I think. He created a virtual robotic and interactive arm, clearly a prosthesis, that's seen as an amplification of bodily possibilities and as a critique of biological implications. That's his intention. Whereas this man, who has lost his arms in an accident and is using double arm prostheses, is understood to be countering a functional failure of embodiment and, of course, recuperating his masculinity. Look, I can fix this car engine again. Now, clearly one of these examples is more technologically advanced than the other, but I would want to insist that's a difference in degree, not kind. That these are both examples of prosthetic use that actually are speaking to precisely the same thing about supplementation. So on the one hand, prosthetic devices are intended to replicate or enhance normative function and appearance, and that figures, of course, a Foucauldian sense of the technological discipline and regulation of the body, but on the other, they are all excessive to the body. And my argument is that the transcorporeality of the organic and the inorganic, the assembly and the disassembly of surprising connections, the capacity to innovate and the troubling intentionality may all be experienced productively by disabled people insofar as they are prepared to explore the uncharted potential of prostheses. And as with other minoritarian thought and practice, like the feminine, the breaking through of the expected limits of the resources to hand can both intensify the decomposition of binaries, body-machine, active-passive, biology, technology, and so on, and multiply non-repressive forms of desire. And this is what Deleuze and Guattari say: desire constantly couples continuous flows and partial objects that are by nature fragmented and fragmentary. Desire causes the current to flow. Now, the move that they make is to ask not what a body is, but what a body can do. And where the disabled body has conventionally been seen as lacking, once the focus has changed, it becomes clear that the experience of the disunified or prosthetic body demands a degree of inventiveness that most people rarely experience. So for Deleuze and Guattari, that connectedness of the body is actually at the heart of creativity. So in place of prohibition, repression and disavowal, Deleuzean desire is expansive, fluid and connected. And it's liberated from the restricted parameters of what's usually defined as sexual. It constitutes an erotics of connection. Now, in an essay on lesbian desire that might equally apply to prosthetic embodiment, Liz Gross says, the coming together of two surfaces produces a trading that imbues eros or libido to both of them, making bits of bodies, its parts or particular surfaces, throb, intensify for their own sake and not for the benefit of the entity or organism as a whole. So above all, what mobilizes or stalls the rhizomatic proliferations of desire is the extent to which the connective modules escape organized patterns of operation. Because the emphasis shifts from the integrity of the whole organism to focus instead on the provisional coming together of disparate parts, there's no need to think of bodies as either whole or broken, able-bodied or disabled, but all of them simply in a process of becoming through the circulation of desire. So desire is not pre-given, it's not possessed by a singular subject, and nor does it flow directly from one individual to another. Instead, it comes into being through what Deleuze and Guattari call desiring machines, assemblages that exist only through their interconnections, and which encompass both the organic and the inorganic. And Guattari explains, there is as yet no question here of structure. Desiring machines arrange and connect flows. They do not recognize distinctions between persons, organs, material flows, and semiotic flows. So a desiring machine expresses then no necessary continuity, nor seeks a return to the illusion of an originary wholeness. What mobilizes the desire are not the endless substitution for psychic loss, but the surface energies and intensities that move in and out of multiple conjunctions that belie categorical distinction or organisation. For Deleuze and Guattari, such nomadic flows of energy extend embodiment way beyond the merely human. And it's not that there's no distinction to be made between one corporeal element and another, or indeed between a human and machine. It's rather that becoming entails an inherent transgression of borders that turns the pleasures of the embodied person away from dominant notions of autonomous human agency. And it speaks to bodies whose fluidity and energies are engaged in mutual transformation. And where the stress is on the multiple possibilities of connection, then anomalous bodies are no longer a source of anxiety, but hold out the promise of productive new becomings. Now, for Deleuze and Guattari, the take-up of this positive mode of productive desire is limited neither to those who already fulfil certain corporeal criteria, nor to the modernist form of autonomous agency. It's a move from the fixity of being to the inventiveness of becoming. So I'm going to miss the next passage, which was about Amy Mullins, but we can leave her out because you probably know all about her. So the question is, how does this work out for everyday people, who, disabled people in particular, who precisely because of their use of prosthetic devices are characterised as dependent and lacking? Now, we've already seen some low-key human animal assemblages, and I want to look briefly now at some work by a Canadian rehabilitation theorist, actually, Barb Gibson, who theorises practical everyday functioning of some severely disabled adults. By listening closely to some of the young men she works with, all of whom required long-term use of ventilators, Gibson realises that the conventional therapeutic drive to achieve some kind of independence bears a clear relationship to what these disabled young men experience. And she turns instead to Deleuze and Guattari and their rejection of the subject defined by autonomy, and to their radical take-up of notions of active becoming that breaks through the bounded limits of the singular self. And she makes clear that her subjects are, quote, both confined to individual bodies and simultaneously connected, overlapping with other bodies, nature and machines. And an illustration of how her approach can make sense of the differential experience of disabled lives, she offers some examples of what she calls transgressive connectivity, which imagine a reimagining of disability itself. So talking about a disabled man who has multiple prostheses, a wheelchair, a ventilator, a gastronomy tube, and a voice synthesizer, Gibson notes not his dependency, but his multiple connections, his exchanges of energy. So I'm just going to skip through. Here we are. He is a fluid body, not a subject, but a conglomeration of energies. He has replaceable parts. His organs are here, there, and everywhere. He is an excitation, a point of contact, a relay on a power grid, a plot point on the plane of consistency. And in a more recent study of a severely disabled 12-year-old girl, she shows how Mimi and her mother are not only interdependent, but more profoundly, their selves connect and merge into assemblages and later disconnect and reconnect with others to form different assemblages. Within these assemblages, there is no clear distinction between persons or between persons and technologies. Now, all of this suggests, I think, that the bodily transgressions associated with disability can be a powerful step towards opening up the dynamic and already unfinished processes of assemblage that in turn point to the unlimited potential of becoming. Desiring machines speak to all manner of couplings, organic and inorganic, that push the experiences of embodiment to a different plane that is as hospitable to people with disabilities as it is to any other. And indeed, insofar as disabled people may have less invested in sovereign subjectivity or are better able to let go of such illusions, it could be more so. Now, I don't want to take an overly romanticised view of this, in which prosthetic performativity always operates the sort of unchallenged positivity. There clearly are some constraints. There are ways that the flows of energy are impeded or intentionality is frustrated. And rehabilitation strategies still remain based on the push for maximum independence, precisely because it's never easy to let go of the idea of a sovereign subject in control of her own agency, even when the body is demanding otherwise. But the model I'm proposing here is not about modernist notions of unrestricted choice or freedom to enjoy every possibility. It's intended as a break with the putative emergence of a coherent subject with fixed and organised desires, and a turn to the libidinal intensities which play across points of connection between disparate entities. So what matters is the transformative potential of the process of becoming. So in being excluded from its conventional models, people with disabilities, I think, have lost little of permanent value. Now, what all this indicates is that the notion of the technologized body focused not on individual agency, but on the emergence of the self through an erotics of connection could transform our understanding, not just of disability, but of all embodiment. And in many ways, the corporeality of disability is already queer in its contestation of the very separation of self and other. And again, it's not that disability is unique, but that all forms of embodiment and the embrace of prosthetics, it shows up the fragility and instability of corporeality in general. Now, when Deleuze and Guattari refer to becoming minoritarian, they're not privileging any given category. They're referring to processes that operate only through assemblages temporarily brought about by radically disparate machinic connections. And these are open to all of us. We can all become minoritarian. So just like the substantive model, like people who are disabled, we have to enter into a process of becoming that entails contesting the relations of power that structure desire only within normative borders. Now, of course, the route is risky and it's uncomfortable, but so long as the disabled body is constituted by the repressive organisation of modernist principles, where certain bodies will never matter, and of course women know this anyway, it may be necessary. If our mutual and irreducible connectivity were recognised as a condition of becoming and as the ground of the productive player's desire, then notions of independent agency and bounded body, the things that mark the normative subject now, would lose their exclusionary power. And in place of the liberal demand for rights, choice, self-determination that presently shape the dominant discourses of disability and many other so-called oppressed groups, and indeed feminist activism, a more productive model that celebrates the qualities of those already living at the margins might be proposed. Now, I'm going to finish with the thought that the technologized body can never be an unproblematized good, but it's already too late to act as though corporeal boundaries were fixed and predictable. So alongside the material crisscrossing of multiple and fluid forms of embodiment, we should, I think, embrace both a prosthetic imaginary and a strategy that reopens the ethical issues of how power might circulate within prosthetic performativity. Now, it's been kind of like hovering around the edges all day, and I don't know if this much heralded technological singularity is really imminent, but whether it is or not, I think we've got a lot of re-evaluation of embodiment ahead of us. Thank you.
Thanks, Margaret. That was really fantastic. I just wanted to. I just want to start with an example. I love the paper, but I think the question that I have, or maybe the kind of comment I have, is that I just wonder whether there's a position somewhere in between the kind of right, liberal, autonomous, bold self and Deleuzean desiring machines, and a process position, but not one that necessarily sees the little bits, the conglomeration little bits of becoming desiring machines. And I think the example that I was thinking about throughout your talk is the example, and I could give lots of others similar examples, but I was thinking of the thalidomide person who's born with two thumbs for arms, and there's many stories of such people who were forced from, I don't know, maybe the age of 3 or 4 to have prosthetic limbs attached to them.
Yeah.
And they had developed, because they were born with no arms, they had developed ways of operating in the world that they found much more comfortable than the ways that were being imposed on them to make them have this normal, quote, some kind of vaguely normalised body. And when I thought about Ben, and I was thinking that whilst I love the notion of subjectivity being constantly in a process of formation, constantly in a process of becoming, it seems to me that maybe there are certain, I just call them potentialities rather than possibilities of an embodied, or kind of, like, I don't know what to call it, because the language is obviously already loaded, but there are some potentialities that are actually open and real possibilities to various kinds of what appears to be an embodied self, and some that are not. And I just wonder if we go too far in the direction of machine, desiring machine, we're actually placing too much emphasis on the autonomous Cartesian whole self and thinking we have to go in the opposite, to the opposite extreme, when no one actually really ever believed. You know, if we think about it properly, no one really believed that. Of course they did, because it's very powerful discourse. But I mean, if you walk around anywhere in what used to be called the third world or the developing world, you know, almost no one fits that image. It's a very, very powerful kind of image, it's more than an image, it's a very powerful discourse. But it's almost forced, you know, people like Deleuze and Guattari to take the opposite line. Isn't somebody like Bergson or somebody like, I don't know, it's like Schelling, I think he is lost, who developed process ontologies that don't go as far as saying they're desiring machines. But, sorry, you're too long.
But it's simply a point of disagreement. I think the sociocultural imaginary, certainly in Western societies, is still very Cartesian. It still does believe in autonomous agency. And, you know, the first paper this morning, we heard about autonomous agency. You know, these terms are in currency all the time. You know, this is no surprise to us. When you get things like anomalous embodiment, and I'm using disability as an example here, but there could be other things. I mean, it could be, for example, transsexuality, it could be intersexuality. There are lots of different forms of this. People are being judged as inadequate, dependent, lacking, whatever, on the basis of a model that says the body should be whole and integrated, and one should be in control of one's own body. You know, so the agency is very clearly that your own agency, and it's autonomous. To be dependent on others is seen as a bad thing. Now, what I'm using Deleuze and Guattari, and, you know, I have huge caution with what I would say, you know, swallowing it whole. I don't want to go all the way with Deleuze and Guattari, but I do want to say what they're doing is pointing a horizon which seems to offer something entirely different, which revalues the ways of quite on the ground everyday lives where connection cannot be avoided. Connection with other people, Mimi and her mother, for example, in the quote I gave you from Barb Gibson, connections to machines, having a transplant, having a prosthetic leg, those unavoidable kinds of things. But going much, much further to bring together all sorts of elements, including, of course, the inorganic and animals at the same time. And this seems to me to be something that we should be thinking about. What it actually requires, of course, is a massive change in our social cultural imaginary, or actually our psychosocial cultural imaginary, which is, it's a dream. It's, you know, it's a horizon of aspiration. It ain't going to happen tomorrow. But I think nobody can even begin to think about it unless we actually take seriously that there are these kind of alternatives, rather than thinking, well, we can take incremental steps. And I understand what you mean by process ontology, but it's the kind of incremental steps that happen that leaves us actually with some bodies that never matter. And that's the point. Some bodies will never matter unless we actually have some kind of transformatory change. And what I'm saying is, why does that keep popping up? The things I'm describing are happening already. They're right before our very eyes. You know, these are not weird things that could happen, like we don't know if technological singularity will happen, but we do know people have transplants. We do know that people have prosthetic limbs. We do know that people are hooked up to voice synthesizers. You know, these are real things that are happening, but we are thinking about them in a way that is totally restrictive, and we could be thinking about them entirely other ways.
Yeah, Mike.
Thank you. I think it's a very welcome question, but it's about that notion of unavoidability you mentioned. So yeah. I'm just trying to think about whether one should, I don't know if this is what you are doing, but whether the learned Agatharian would flatten out the distinction between someone being prepared to say something and someone who wasn't, who had desires. Mm. It's just that notion of unavoidability. You suggested that what characterized someone who had a transplant and someone who was disabled is that there is an unavoidable necessity, there's an unavoidable dependency upon technology, for instance.
Mm.
I wonder, does that unavoidability mean that you're reasserting some difference between the disabled person and someone who isn't? Because I wonder if you haven't...
Well, you know, look, I'm reliant on technology. I'm reliant on technology. Here are my prostheses, my clothes, my glasses, my machine. You know, we're all dependent. This is unavoidable. What I'm trying to talk about is not prostheses in that very, very narrow sense. It's prostheses in this wide sense of coming together with others, coming together with organic others and inorganic others. And that's precisely the point. That's where it, in a sense, I don't want to flatten out distinctions because, of course, the distinctions are hugely, hugely important. The differences are massively specific and should be held. But the actual coming together, the assemblage, is something experienced by all of us. Only some people are forced to recognize it. And unfortunately, they're forced to view it as dependency rather than what I'm calling the erotics of connection. Sorry, I cut you off. I'm sure there was something else.
No, I was just trying to wonder if a notion of, I mean, you wouldn't die without those things that you're, these processes that you're attached to now, but we're talking about people who may be attached to a machine in order to stay alive.
Yeah.
And whether that, I was wondering vaguely whether that reintroduces the notion of a lack, which
I don't think it does at all. I mean, clearly some people would die. I guess most prostheses for people who are disabled in the everyday sense that we understand that you're not going to die, but life would be more difficult. Some people clearly do need respirators and they would die. Some people do need a transplant and they would die. So there's a range, but I don't think we can make any distinction around life and death, which I'm trying not to go off at a tangent because I have a whole nother paper about the distinction between life and death, which is very relevant to what you're saying. But I don't think there is a distinction there. But to say we can't make a distinction in that broad sense doesn't say we can't understand the differences of the experience of being part of an erotics of connection. My assemblage would be very, very different if I were on a respirator than it is actually now. So, you know, I'm pointing to a laptop because, you know, I'm sitting at a desk giving a paper. Now, that's a very, very different experience. But those, you know, in Deleuzean terms, would both be flows of energy. They would both be transfers of power. They would both be productive of desire. And that seems to me to be the common ground, not whether or not it's extreme for some people or they're going to die. And for some other people, I can choose not to use a laptop. I don't think that's the case. Even if I thought I could divest myself of my dependencies, you can't. I mean, all of us are dependent at some level on all sorts of things. I mean, just you know, simple things like we clothe ourselves. These are prostheses. These are supplements to our body. It's as simple as the everyday things like clothing and it's extreme as some of the really, really high-tech technologies. But all of them, I think, can be theorised on a similar level. Now, I'm also very, very clear that I don't ever wish to hold true to a Deleuzean canon. What I see Deleuze as being useful, as suggesting ideas, and then you see, how can I make this work in a different way? You know, Deleuze doesn't talk about people with disabilities. How can I make this work? How can I actually begin to use some of these ideas in more productive ways? So, you know, if you are a Deleuzean expert, you might say, oh, but you're using that term in a way he never did. Well, I know that. But it's, what can we do with it? And this is what I think feminist philosophy is particularly good at. It's like taking the toys from the boys and saying, look, we can do something entirely different with these terms and make them work in another kind of way. And I think that's very exciting.
I was just sort of curious if there's a problem. I know at the beginning you mentioned that this is not connected to the more kind of socio-political discussions of disability.
Mm.
But the idea that specifically with reference to the recycle me thing,
yeah.
That idea of as the body is just a receptacle of value, that that can be transferred in any way just becomes another commodity.
Yeah.
The problem with a kind of the kind of Deleuzean energetic metaphysics is that not very, very close to the cultural logics of capitalism, of neoliberalism, that we're just kind of erasing the thing. How does what you're suggesting set itself against neoliberal capitalism?
Well, it's not specifically setting itself against neoliberal capitalism, as I said. I mean, I think that Recycle Me is unbelievably neoliberal, quite clearly.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what I'm talking about is something else. How can we get outside a certain psychocultural imaginary? How can we reimagine embodiment in a different kind of way that shifts the whole question of value? Now, what neoliberalism is doing is saying, right, we're giving all the individuals their own options, choices, freedom. You know, you're responsible for how much you're valued. Now, it's nothing like that. That particular ad I showed, not because I support it, I think it's the most ridiculous ad, because it precisely says, look, you can do this. And it used to be Gift of Life, and, you know, a lot of it still is. And I think that one has been explicitly set up because the Gift of Life simply didn't appeal to some people. They didn't want to be altruistic donors. But they thought, oh, you know, I believe in ecology and ecological concerns and recycling, so this is supposed to appeal to them. But that definitely is within the logics of neoliberalism, no doubt about it. But I think the Deleuzean stuff, to me, opens up a whole different way in which you could imagine, what would it be to transform the psychocultural imaginary? What would it look like? And what it looks like to me at the moment is much more to do with the idea of an erotics of connection. You don't even have to use the word assemblages, but that, you know, basically that's the kind of Deleuzean take that you would have. And of course, we can start deconstructing it. How would it work politically? Could it be slotted into neoliberal ideas? And pessimistically, like everything else, probably it could. But what we have to do, what our task is, what philosophy's task is to think differently. That's what we're trying to do.
Thanks very much for the talk. I'm just sort of thinking aloud here as well. So correct me when I go wrong. In interpreting what you said. I'm just thinking about the relationship between prosthetics and the sort of amalgam. The language of prosthetic strikes me as potentially anthropocentric. Maybe I'm wrong in saying that, or maybe that is not a problem, but in the sense that it can potentially be viewed as sort of starting from the human and viewing the prosthetic as sort of supplementary and add-on. Whereas, just sort of thinking through this from a different sort of theoretical approach, someone like Bruno Latour, who wouldn't use the language of prosthetic, I don't think, so much as something like mediation and acting.
Yeah.
And in doing so, would try to kind of completely flatten any difference, not any difference, but the primacy, or get rid of the primacy of human over non-human. So we would talk about the connections between humans and non-humans without privileging
mm-hmm.
one or the other. Question in there somewhere, I suppose.
But
I
mean, I'm really surprised you think that privileges the human, because I was, you know, it's a cut-down paper, of course, but I mean, the point is all the time to be saying the connections could be anything. So in the example of the man that was in a study that Carl Gibson was doing, who uses a gastronomy tube and then, you know, a ventilator and, you know, electric this and electric that, the whole point is that the flows of energy don't stop with the human and don't start with the human. You know, he is part of a whole environment which, you know, just to pull one element out of that relies on how does electricity get transported or transposed. I don't know what the right word is, but, you know, you can go right back to the towering falls that generate hydroelectric power. So it's a hugely expansive thing in which the human becomes fairly insignificant and just another element in that total erotics of connection, in that assemblage. So because I'm talking about disability, naturally I'm talking about human beings because that's where we're starting. Mm-hmm. But where it takes you is totally away from that. It takes you into thinking about connection in all sorts of ways. And that's precisely why I wanted to say it's not just about the human to human or the human to animal. It's also about the inorganic. Now, I think it goes much further than Bruno Latour, because Bruno Latour, to me, has got kind of caught up in this flattening thing that goes on. So when you start to talk about the environment as accents, you've lost the difference. I think the difference is incredibly important. The specifics of the difference are incredibly important. But all of those things are linked together in this connective tissue, if you like. But they're all part things. They're not, you know, the whole body. They're not complete in themselves. They're little bits and parts of all sorts of different things coming together. And, of course, breaking apart. And that kind of energetics seems to me something that I don't read in Latour at all. I mean, let's be honest, I haven't read Latour in his most recent work. I have probably missed in all sorts of stuff, but I didn't ever find Latour took me where I wanted to go, put it like that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I agree with you, especially the point about you do lose something, I think, in that language of accent, and assuming that technology and humans and non-humans are on par with especially, at least given sort of my concerns in terms of research that I do, you lose the sense of power dynamic that I think they're truly identity. As I said, speaking aloud, though.
Andy?
Thanks very much for the talk. I just have one. Well, I agree with you, I think. I think what you're, if I'm correct in what you're saying, I think what you're trying to say, or what I think you're trying to say, is that, you know, that our conception of organs is just in a bit of an identity crisis in the conception of ourselves. You know, we need to be less Cartesian, seeing ourselves as a substance as such, and we need to get some more dynamic account of ourselves. And this is why, you know, we can prospect for organs. Yeah. So I thought maybe one possible way of kind of overcoming this conceptual misconception would be blood transfusion, for instance, where there's not a particular entity which we think is other than, but it's that you can't really separate someone else's blood from your own blood. And it doesn't create this kind of crisis in the individual, is it?
Ooh, you don't know the half of it. Trust me, I work a lot in bioscience.
Okay.
They're telling you lies about blood transfusions. There are all sorts of chimeric elements in blood transfusions. The authorised version is 7 weeks later, any sign of a transfusion has gone. So you're transfusing different DNA into your body.
Mm.
And 7 weeks later, that DNA has disappeared. Forget it. It's still there.
Mm.
Yeah. So, in fact, there is a crisis. There is an ontological crisis. It's just that we get quiet.
But it is a crisis in the fact that we see ourselves as unified, or is it that...
The crisis is that we see ourselves as unified, and therefore there's always a gap between the story that we are told about ourselves, i.e. the psychoculture and imaginary tells us this story about unification, wholeness, etc., etc., gender,
yeah.
Everything that we have talked about. But the gap is, it doesn't happen like that, and certain people get to realise. So in the transplant project, for example, the authorised version is you're given the gift of life, and you would have died. That's the only reason you're going to get a heart. You would have died. You're given the gift of life. You're supposed to be really happy. Lots of people would catch it in terms of rebirth. Very common metaphor that's used. But 80% of those people in our phenomenological study are deeply distressed. Deeply distressed. You measure precisely those same people on quality of life instruments. And 70% are extremely happy, which is the national average in Canada. You know, so what the story, the authorised discourse, the story that we are told about ourselves is not matching up with people's own experiences. And transplantation is a very, I mean, you know, this is a project that's been going on for about 8 years, so I have tons and tons and tons of information on it. And it's all about the gaps. And it's all about the lack of match. So more and more and more you think, yes, the problem is that we have this image of wholeness, singularity, integrity, the Cartesian self. And, you know, Alison said, well, we don't really believe in the Cartesian self. Well, we don't. I hope everybody doesn't. But it's still there in the authorised discourse of the clinic. It's still there in the sociocultural imaginary. You know, it's still there in everyday life with the language of rights and justice. It's always there. It's there in neoliberalism for sure.
Yeah.
That's the problem. So yes, absolutely.
Has anyone else got any questions I'd like to ask? We finish? No? All right, that's wonderful. Thanks very much, Margaret.
Well, thank you all.
Thanks.